まもなく、振り出しポットが参ります。ご注意ください。
Something I wanted to ask you about, since you brought up kind of like the broader corporate culture in the games industry, and also I think this is indicative of like the Valley period, which is that like
the Valley being what,
like Silicon Valley, like the entire
Silicon Valley,
the entire like tech blob, for lack of
because in LA the Valley is considered like north of LA,
that's right,
and so my brain literally was like, the Valley.
You live in the Bay Area. I thought you assumed that.
Anyway, because we don't call it the Valley. That's why.
Okay. Well, that's just me revealing my parochial Midwesternness.
Okay. You live in the Silicon Prairie.
The Silicon Prairie? No. No, we are the
That's what they called it.
No. It's the Creative Corridor.
It was also the Silicon Prairie back in 2K14. It was...
All I have to say about that, that's my entire set of feelings about that.
Okay, you can take it.
No, because all these terms, like, you know, like it's all bullshit. Even like Silicon Valley is kind of bullshit because for various reasons. No, the thing that I want to
ask me your question.
No, the question I was going to ask you about was, so I was recently reading about like it's not even a mass exodus from Blizzard anymore. It's like this constant exodus from Blizzard, like this massive storied company that supposedly is the one that has like the history and all of the people who are committed to it for years and years and years. Now, even like original co-founders are leaving and starting their own studios. And I remember, like, we talked a long time ago about how one of the weird ways in which, like, the games industry and academia are similar is this sort of mercenary attitude that people often have, where, like, they're constantly moving between, you know, from one project to another. They only stay with a company long enough, essentially, for, like, the production cycle for a particular game or maybe, you know, series of games. And so you end up with a lot of companies that don't even really have a culture except for like on paper. They're just sort of like temporary assemblages of persons.
Yep.
I was wondering what you think about that and like whether or not that's productive or like what are the positives and negatives of that?
Yeah. So I think that like back in games early history, and obviously having not been in early games history, circa like, and when I say early, I am not talking about early games 1960, 1970. I am going to reference
back when you were working for Atari.
Yeah. Back when I was working for Atari. I'm going to a little bit like Atari or Midway. Like, you know, I've read my video game history course books. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
But basically like, if you look at like the history of video games, a lot of that mercenary attitude really did come from, right, games being new, games being something that everyone had to, like, it wasn't easy to get into, kind of had to know somebody. But that whole culture, right, it still really hasn't changed. And it hasn't changed because those people are still alive. Like, so when I mention, like, early games history, you have to be thinking of these people that have the 30, 40, or 50 years in games. I don't even know if someone has had 50 years. I don't know if games has been around 50 years, but I'm sure there's someone somewhere.
Yeah, I think most of those people would probably be retired by now.
They're retired and maybe they're making books, right? So they're writing books about how they started their studios, right? So 50 years, right? We have these people that are writing the literature, because once you retire, you write literature about what you've done, right?
Yeah.
And maybe if you're really super forethoughtful, you decide to write about what you would want to do if you were 50 years younger and you wanted to start it all over again. I haven't seen that book yet, but I would love to. I believe Sid Meier actually just did his memoir. as well that just came out that I haven't read yet, but a lot of my colleagues have like enjoyed.
Yeah, I don't
and,
know.
And I
sorry, go ahead. I don't know how much. I was just going to say, I don't know how much you know about like the early history of Firaxis, which was so, and also like the early, I know, actually, so I'm a huge SimCity fan. I mean, a lot of Sid Meier's, I mean, when I was a kid, I really loved Pirates. Pirates was a great game. Still is kind of a great game. It's sort of corny now, but still fun. But Firaxis was interesting from what I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was a sort of like, I don't want to say it was like the first indie studio, but it sort of was, it had a lot of the elements that sort of then later bled into the sort of like indie studio or like indie developer mentality.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I'm getting at. When you look at like business development and you bring into like Silicon Valley, you have something that's called the startup mentality, and the startup mentality is like fail fast, right? And find your success first and find it really quickly. And honestly, in games, like that's kind of necessary. It's fail fast, then find the fun.
Yeah.
And it's kind of permeated all of history. And then you end up getting some really great games that take 10 years to make. So circa, right, Blizzard, what you mentioned. And you could say they're not really failing fast in scare quotes here, because fail fast is a it's not a terrible methodology, but I just don't think it's a sustainable methodology.
Well, and also, so
and that gets into the nature of culture as well.
Yeah, but to use the example of Blizzard, like the games that they've had the greatest success with are the ones that have a lot of longevity. I mean, their most successful game, and nobody wants to admit this, but maybe some people would, but their most successful game is World of Warcraft. And the reason why that game is so successful is because of its longevity. Like, it's an old fucking game now, and in many ways, it's not
what is old is new again. Last year, WoW Classic came out. I'm actually speaking to a huge WoW fan, so like this will be really exciting for you. We all feel your pain. Every WoW fan's like, oh, I really used to like WoW, and then like Cataclysm happened.
Yeah, basically the transition from Wrath of Lich King to Cataclysm did me in. Especially because in every MMO I've ever played, you know, even going all the way back to like stupid EverQuest, like I always play healers. And healing in WoW for the longest time felt like it was powerful. Like in most games, healing feels very underpowered.
Mm-hmm,
and even though I love Final Fantasy XIV, my primary frustration with that game is that healing is insane. Like it's really unforgiving, extremely unforgiving. Like if you mess up like one cast, it's a wipe. It's a great, thanks guys. Whereas in, especially like, so healing in vanilla was not great, basically because the only healer was priest. Or paladins if you were alliance, because paladins were very good tank healers.
We had a shaman healer once. That wasn't too bad.
Oh, that's true. Shamans were much better like AoE healers. But also like vanilla didn't require that much AoE healing. Not really.
Yeah, but if you had a shadow priest, you would have a shaman healer.
Yeah, I suppose.
Because then you could always have your backup priest and just like swap. Because I actually was a primary healer, but my main spec was shadow. Okay. And I say this because I say this kind of sarcastically or ironically, if you will, because this was last year of 2019 when I was playing WoW Classic.
I played Classic for a couple of months too, actually. I leveled a priest.
We should have hit each other up because you could have been in my Discord guild.
Yeah,
I now switched over to like Fall Guys and Among Us.
Because the problem is that it reminded me of everything that I hated about Classic. Like, especially compared to modern MMOs, like the grind was just so
tedious. Horrible. Yeah. So, but okay. So looking at Blizzard's longevity of their game titles and their
or like StarCraft, StarCraft has a lot of longevity. Yeah.
Nope. StarCraft, Diablo, every game that they did had a lot of longevity. Honestly, even Warcraft did. Yeah. And I don't think Blizzard was expecting World of Warcraft to take off like it did.
Maybe. Yeah.
Right? I really don't think so. Because when you get into any sort of game, you don't look at your game and think like, this is the game that is going to make us $1 billion.
True, yeah.
Right? You're like, this is the game that's going to have like maybe 1 million players. Now we are, there are companies though looking at games that are in the AAA sector. And there's even laughingly like something called Quad A, which is a great, is a nice joke. But like the AAA sector where you're going to be making billions of dollars from a property and you're going to have 24 million sales and 24 million players on any given day. Yeah. And in those types of properties, this is really where I see like this schism happening, is because whenever you have, right, the multitude of masses, right, or the multiplication of it, where it's from like 10 people, they're going to play your game, to 100,000 people, to a million people, you suddenly have a higher amount of expectancy for meeting your deadlines. You have a higher company, like amount of people that need to just be there, bodies in the room, because there aren't enough tasks for any one person to complete. And then that is what gets down to culture. Because a lot of studios, when they were founded, were probably founded on that startup indie mentality of the fail fast, right? We're going to get agile. Yeah. And they were a lot smaller. And honestly, a lot of the best kind of creativity, I think, does come from those smaller teams. From a lot of my business development coursework, and even in my master's program, we did a lot of these kind of like, what is the most like creative versus like what gets the most stuff done.
Yeah.
And basically there was like Skunk Works, where like there was no oversight, right? Waterfall, where everything is, right, very, you know, it's Ford's like factory, right, method. And kind of like Agile, where it's supposed to be this mix of both. But the production methodologies, game development methodologies, like none of this is formulaic. So there isn't really any one solution that can even solve task management. And because every property and every game is completely different, there isn't even, say, one type of like culture or one type of production cycle that actually can accurately predict everything. And so when business falls, right, and starts to fail to execute its deliverables or fail to do things, then like, say, the business like overlords decide to take over, in scare quotes again, but kind of look at it and say, how can we solve this from a business perspective? They're not thinking about it creatively anymore. They're thinking about it from business perspective, because now it's sheets on a line, right?
Yeah.
And this isn't necessarily bad, but when we look at culture in like, say, all companies, if we look at culture specifically in games, you now realize that as soon as the creatives, right, are no longer allowed to do like the Skunk Works, are no longer allowed to kind of report back up but have that creativity, they no longer are creating art. They are just executing tasks. Because at the end of the day, a lot of game development has hard skills, but your soft skills, which what I would consider communication and art and all of that, and I don't like them being called hard and soft, but for the purposes of an audio podcast, we can delineate between the two.
Yeah.
That level design is a hard skill. It has soft skill components like presentation of elements and has more artistic flair, but just like code, level design is a hard skill. You have to learn and understand what goes into those practices. Right.
So
and
maybe,
sir,
I'd like to interject here, because I think maybe a more meaningful distinction here would be that sort of there's a spectrum between sort of more like mechanical tasks and more creative tasks.
Yes.
And that,
yeah,
and that,
that's
and
much
that if,
better.
And that if you look at like all of the various like jobs, or I guess you could say divisions of how like game design is broken up, you can generally place someone somewhere on that continuum between like having more mechanical or more creative oriented tasks. So like someone who's doing, say, like writing dialogue or doing voice acting, they would be much further down on the like creative aspect. Whereas someone who's doing, say, like, I don't know, maybe even like doing like models is sort of like dead center, because it sort of like splits the difference between like the creative aspect and the mechanical part.
Right,
and
right.
Then someone who's doing scripting is like, you know, way, way over here.
No, exactly. And so, but there's, even with scripting and with coding, there is a little bit of creativity involved if, say, you're creating something like a new feature. And now suddenly you're back in the dead center. And a lot of game design, which I love, happens in the dead center. It happens in the middle of creativity and mechanical, right?
Yeah.
And what ends up happening when culture goes awry, what I would argue is that everything becomes mechanical. There is no more creative. Creativity has been outsourced. And so whenever you start outsourcing creativity, where it's the productions or business or someone calling themselves a director, whenever you outsource creativity, you are now outsourcing your culture, because culture is something that's very creative, right? It's really led from the heart. It's what you value.
Yeah.
And creativity is a value. So if you take that value away, now you just have a bunch of mechanical, right? And the mechanics are robots. A robot could plug in, say, numbers that you get from your boss's spreadsheet. A robot could model, right? It's not going to be very good. because there is still some creativity needed. But if you're like, go AI program and model me an amazing character, it's going to do it because it's math, right? Yeah. The program is math.
Well, I mean, plus like, you know, AI can build levels as well. I mean, that's essentially what most modern roguelikes are. There's generates levels.
Ooh, and every procedural generated level designer / roguelike designer just like turned over in their procedural grave to start the next level.
I don't care.
There's a lot of level design that goes.
That's part of the problem is that like I should apologize because I don't actually think that. I mean, I know
you don't think it. That's why I brought it up. I was like,
You're moving over into the snarky mode that you tend to. But here's the thing. Like the point is still sound. Like it's the same thing. It's like it may not necessarily be good, but like it can be generated in the same way that models can be generated. In the same way that like even dialogue can be generated, although generated dialogue tends to be really awful in a way that like generated models and levels don't.
No, absolutely. And so here is where I get to the heart of the culture dialogue/discussion that we're having, is that whenever creativity is taken and everything becomes mechanical, these people are leaving these companies because as a creative, you think, let me see how this plays out. Right? Like, let's figure this out. Maybe I can be creative in different ways, or maybe I can apply this in a different way. But then you realize when it doesn't work and the culture starts to break down and, or at least deteriorate, right? And it no longer aligns with your values. Well, then you have no choice but to leave and to establish a culture with people that share those values and share that culture. And personally, I really like this kind of approach. And I like seeing a lot of this kind of, I don't want to call it an exodus because that's not, maybe that's what's happening on some front, but on another
I think that's what's happening to Blizzard. I don't think it's what's happening in general.
Yeah. I haven't actually, I mean, Blizzard gets a lot of press. Having a lot of friends in Blizzard, I don't know if they would describe it as an exodus either. So I'll have to
certainly,
talk
certainly
to
from
them
the outside
back,
looks like an exodus. Essentially,
but from the outside, it looks like an exodus.
I mean, especially when like Morheim left to start his own studio, like that's kind of a big deal. Like when literally like, one of your core people from like the beginning history of your company has had enough. I mean, it may not necessarily like signal the great downfall of Blizzard that so many people on YouTube are talking about now, which I think that's BS, but it does mean that it's a very different company now.
It is. And I think the issue, whenever you see someone leave a company, you need to remember that it's not that it's a very different company because they left. It is a very different company, and that is why they left.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people kind of look at someone leaving and then go, oh, everything's going to change. Actually, everything's going to stay the same. That person is now leaving to go do something different because they no longer could affect the change they wished to see at their current company.
Yeah.
Right. So yes, he left, but like, it's not going to be the downfall of Blizzard because like, he probably wasn't in charge of a lot of the things that are actually leading to its rise.
Well, Blizzard, Blizzard also makes, Blizzard makes too much money to fail. It's essentially like the game's equivalent of too big to fail.
Please don't fail. I love you, all of my friends that work at Blizzard. And I also love what you're doing.
Again, I have ambivalent feelings.
But also Shadowlands.
Yeah. I have ambivalent feelings about Blizzard. I mean, actually the thing is like, when I heard about the Shadowlands delay, I thought that was actually positive because it means
that someone, super positive.
Someone finally said like, oh wait, no, all of this feedback that we're getting is really bad. Like we can't ship this game in a couple of weeks because like there are things that are broken. And someone finally said like, no, we have to delay. And the thing is, Blizzard has done this before. It's not like this is earth shattering. Like they did this with Burning Crusade. Burning Crusade was delayed precisely because it was, well, not that it was broken. It was basically unfinished. And then they took the time to finish, and Burning Crusade was actually quite good. It still had all of the WoW problems, and which I can get into, but I don't really want to right now. But as a WoW expansion, as the first WoW expansion went, it was a huge success precisely because it built upon a core that was already there and then it expanded it. And
I actually came in on Burning Crusade.
And I think where Blizzard has failed is when they try to, like, when you see saw like the huge subscriber drop off between Wrath of the Lich King and Cataclysm, and then also shortly after the release of Mist of Pandaria, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that people felt like it was a radically different game. Like, mm-hmm. it wasn't expanding upon something that already existed. It had sort of changed it fundamentally. And some people liked that fundamental change, but a lot of people who had, over the course of several years, had gotten used to something else were like, I just don't want to play this anymore. Like, this is too different for me.
Yeah, so I actually had that come up in an interview once where someone was basically like, hey, so I see that you play WoW. And I was like, why, yes. How may I give assistance? and it basically came to, what did you think about, you know, World of Warcraft's fundamental change after Cataclysm? I personally love those types of changes, but what I don't like to see is the user base drop off of, just as a game designer. Yeah. And so like what I would have done from the start was always to have had a vanilla or say like a non-Kazakh, a pre-Cataclysm server, if you will. Yeah. But as a player and as like a, I guess as a human, I love change. I've had change all my life. So I'm actually very comfortable when things completely change around me. But then after a while, if it sticks around, COVID, I actually, you know, don't like it. And I'm suddenly like, wait, my core fundamental of loving change is now being called into question because this is not the right change that I wanted. And so I loved Cataclysm. I loved the change. I kind of dropped after Wrath of the Lich King as well. And that was just more because of like studies and just lack of like gaming computer in college and like other things like that.
Yeah.
But I didn't really pick it back up until Classic. I basically was playing retail before Classic came out.
Yeah, I didn't play again until Classic either.
Yeah.
I mean,
which is funny because
oh, no, that's not true. That's not true. Sorry, I am lying. I am a liar. I played.
It's okay. We all lie.
I played Legion briefly.
Oh, I'm playing Legion right now, and I actually really love it. Like, so funny story is that people go back to Classic and they played exact like things that they wanted to do. Mm. I ended up just really wanting to have that guild experience, and so I got like four of my friends together, and then five, so we would have like a dungeon group. And then basically, like, this is back in the day where you just needed five alts or, like, five other humans. And we ended up getting, like, I think 8 or 9 humans to get a guild. So we had 10 and an alt to put, like, 10 people to make this guild with our 10 silver, like, very much getting on it. But I actually played a priest. I'd never played a priest before. And I played undead. I'd never played horde before. And so I didn't get any of that.
You literally played an undead priest? I played an undead priest as well.
Oh, you know what? Undead priest for the win. Because every single person I know that plays undead priest is, like, super legit. So we're the elite.
I don't know if I was legit. The only thing that I have to
know, you as a person are legit. Whether or not you were legit in WoW is totally debatable.
My only real accomplishment was back in vanilla, I made general. That's it.
Okay. That's pretty good.
And it was weird because it's
the PvP thing. Did not PvP like once.
So general is the, if I remember correctly, it's the rank just below. So it was rank 13, essentially. I was trying to remember the term for it, but I made rank 13. So rank 14 was the highest at the time. But I did it as a level 59 character. Wow. Because I played entirely in the 50s bracket. And I was able to grind a lot of honor because there was this regular group that we had on Horde that, we sort of like... We gamed the system back before, like, the modern iteration of, like, classic PvP is just insane. Like, people who essentially, like, while PvPing are staring at spreadsheets, and it's like, oh, I've hit honor cap, and we need to boost you, and no, now we need to boost you, and it's just like, I can't. No, it's just not fun, because it's all about, like, gaming the system rather than actually, like, playing, and that was just... That to me, that was what was fundamentally.
Yeah, that's a whole another podcast episode is gaming the system versus playing the system.
Like, and so this is kind of part of the reason, since both of us have played MMOs in the past, it was one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about Final Fantasy 14, because I was a skeptic. Many of the reasons have to do with sort of a lot of the aesthetic choices the game makes. Like, most of my gripes with the game are about, okay, so the thing that bothers me the most, and I don't know, maybe this is appropriate or inappropriate, but so like every single either like pants or shorts or anything that has like a defined crotch for like female models has like the most egregious camel toe you could possibly imagine. It's kind of weird. And it's
why are you looking?
Because literally, okay, so it's the problem of, you know, okay, well, you can't see what I'm doing. So like, maybe I'll mime it here. So like
I'm glad I can't see it.
The text that you read, so, you know, like when you have a quest and like they do like, you know, the Final Fantasy style cutscenes where like the model's mime talking and then, you know, there's the text at the bottom of the screen. And so like the text is literally like where most people's waists are. So like you have to look there if you want to read what is going on. Otherwise you're just gonna be like click, 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 and you can't see anything.
I understand. No, but I mean, I was joking with you.
But generally speaking, actually I like the I do like the design with certain exceptions of the gear in the game, because like even low level gear looks kind of good. Like it looks nice. And it made me think of like WoW gear where, you know, you get like the first robe and it's just gray, like maybe like a black band.
So I think so with WoW, right, they were trying to have you chase like the end game. Like the whole point was to just level up as fast as you could, which was like 5 days if you're only leveling with like a group, and really 8 days is average. 8 full days, so 8 times 24, everybody doing the math outside of our rooms. And Final Fantasy, though, is about actually chasing. It is really more like celebrating the gear chase, which is why it's so aesthetic, right? Like, I love the costume designs of Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah.
Like, I love them. I do not play Final Fantasy 14, but all my friends do and are sad. I really want to play Genshin Impact. We can.
I could probably do with, like, less bondage fetish gear. There's also this whole like subculture in the game of like instances that people like set up specifically for like domination chat and role play, and it's fine.
I mean, that's gonna be everywhere. I'm sure WoW has it. We just haven't found it yet.
Yeah, it's true. It's not, well, it's not literally in the, like, the thing is in Final Fantasy 14, it's literally like the first thing that comes up in the duty finder. Like, you know, you bring it up, you know, to look for a group, and it's like, it's just this long list of like essentially like cat doms and cat femmes, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, at least people are exploring their sexuality. That's nice. But I do need to do this dungeon. But I actually need to find a group to do this dungeon. Because the thing is, to me, what's most interesting about it is how the main progression through the game is extremely story focused. And it you can level from essentially 1 to max level, which is 80. But I'm only playing the free trial version. I'm sort of cheating at the moment, because you can play a lot of the game just as a free trial. You can level up to 70 just with the free trial version of the game. So I'm playing the main storyline, and the main storyline is a Final Fantasy game. It's actually just like a multiplayer Final Fantasy game. And it's kind of great, to be perfectly honest. And it's fast. Like, maybe it takes as long as a Final Fantasy game, but because that narrative thread runs through the entire progression, like, you actually can just grind, like, especially as a healer, because I'm playing a healer, like, you can just grind dungeons and you can level like that, because you will instantly get groups. And there's an interesting mechanic in Final Fantasy 14 where, like, the classes that are more desirable for groups at that particular time, so like if there's a paucity of tanks, then tanks get bonus experience for doing dungeons. And so the thing is, this is pretty much always the case for healers, because there are very few here. Like, it has a really, really, really low quotient of healers in the game. And I think it's probably because of certain design decisions. So yeah, if you wanted to level as a healer, you could probably do it in like 24 hours.
That's crazy to me, easily. Honestly. But at the same time, when we were looking at our metrics for leveling up our characters, we were looking at that 24-hour mark as well for one person, right? But unfortunately, because of just time and design decisions, I mean, I always push for more than 24 hours because I like the long end game chase. That's kind of my thing. Yeah. But yeah, we were also looking at 24, and it's because of the Final Fantasy. It must be like the Final Fantasy, like, comparable.
Maybe.
Because I've heard Destiny 2 is also about 24 hours, but that's with
Destiny's
light
pretty
level,
fast, yeah,
not necessarily
yeah.
level. Because it's pretty fast versus WoW, right? And usual yeah. MMOs take like 60 hours. Like 60 is your good minimum. Whether it's
oh, no,
like
but it used to be even worse than that. Like one
oh,
of-
Oh, yeah.
One
it used of to be
WoW,
8 days.
Yeah, one of WoW's major improvements over like, say, EverQuest, which up until WoW's release was the largest MMO. Like mm-hmm. EverQuest, the leveling grind is crazy. And you basically like, and it's boring. It's both crazy and boring because the fastest way to level in that game is essentially for someone who is like max level to take you to an area where there are like rapidly respawning mobs that are about, you know, anywhere between 5 and 10 levels above you, and just have you tag them and then kill them for you for hours and days and weeks.
I mean, like that's a philosophy. That's a thing. Yeah.
So I've told you I could rant on and on about Final Fantasy 14, both good and bad, but I want to hear about
I could rant a little bit, only in that I will say that the biggest complaint I've heard about Final Fantasy 14 is because that growth is so fast and you get to the end game. The end game is a bunch of dungeons. And then in order to get the story, though, you have to play the dungeon. And I think most people would somehow prefer to be able to get to that narrative payload without actually having to find the entire group. Well, specifically, I say dungeon, but I mean raid. Like yeah. The raid is apparently so hard and so stressful, like you're saying, with one heal. And if you fuck it up, you now are going to completely wipe. Well, suddenly you have to right now completely redo it just to get that story. And so if there was an easier or more accessible way to get that narrative, I think that WoW has done a really good job of that. That's all I can say on Final Fantasy 14. Obviously just
okay.
Cut that topic
so, I mean,
short
I,
now and-
is there, I mean, there's so many different, no, actually, but there's an interesting point here. So one of the major fundamental, so we're talking about game design. So one of the fundamental like design differences between Final Fantasy 14 and World of Warcraft is the global cooldown. The global cooldown in WoW is much faster. So in WoW, the global cooldown is base 1.5 seconds. And I don't know if this is still the case, but you used to be able to reduce the global cooldown with haste. I don't think you can do that anymore. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Final Fantasy 14, it's 2.5 seconds base. But the way they design skills is that there's a set of skills that are on the global cooldown and there's a set of skills that are off the global cooldown. So the ones that are on the global cooldown are the ones that you're going to be using more repetitively. So, you know, your basic damage spells, you know, your basic like threat generating abilities, and then also like, you know, your basic healing spells, be they like single target or AoE. And then for most classes, and I think this is less true of healers, but for like tanks and for DPS, the off the global cooldown abilities have fairly low reset timers. So they have anywhere between like 3 and 10 second resets. So you can actually establish a fairly like consistent rotation and pattern. With healing, because you basically have to be like hard casting at all times, the ones that are off the global cooldown tend to be like, oh shit buttons. So they tend to be like, you know, an instant cast, like full HP heal on an extremely long cooldown. Or there are things like a mana regen ability that you can pop that has like, I think it has a minute cooldown. At least that's true for like white mages, and it's also true for astrologians as well. But most of the time, you're just hard casting, especially as a direct healer, like a white mage, you're just cast, 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 cast. And if any one of those casts lands either too late or lands on someone who like is already healed to full, and then like after the heal lands, they take a ton of damage, like you can wipe. And as a new player, I have to say that like healing is not only unforgiving just from like a mechanical perspective, it's also unforgiving from a social perspective. Because most people who are running dungeons, they want to like pull everything and AoE it down. And that is extremely hard on the healer.
Yep.
And like, I have a lot of experience playing healers in a lot of different games. Like literally the second I started playing, it's, you play a conjurer before you play a white mage. It just turns into a white mage after a quest. I was like writing macros to make sure that I had focus targets and, you know, all the things that I know from other games that like, you know, make healing easier and more efficient. But in my case, it wasn't making it more efficient. It was making it possible. Like I had to do all that just to be stressed out and succeed.
Yeah. So I played a lot of like support classes is what I do. And I didn't play a full healer until WoW Classic. And honestly, WoW Classic is always WoW Classic. I should just say World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
World of Warcraft has always been known as something that made games like EverQuest and like Ultima like accessible. It made it available to a lot of people who weren't familiar with those types of properties, but also people who wanted to get into a game and were familiar with other types of games and then just came into World of Warcraft and were like, I understand this. And yeah, there's a learning curve to it, but I can understand it. I can be a contributing member of, say, like society. And I think that's kind of where WoW really continues to succeed, is that where there's other games that have come out of it and other MMOs like Final Fantasy XIV that on some level, they never seem to hit my marker of satisfaction for another MMO that I can play. And I say that because I couldn't actually pay for WoW for a lot of it. And so like I would get like WoW gift cards, right, for summer or for winter from my parents. And then I'd be able to play it for like the month, or I would be able to play it for 4 months or whatever.
Yeah.
Like 4 months during the summer. There's only 2 months off during the summer, but whatever. Yeah. Right? Like they came in three month like cards, right? Or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. You could get them in 1 and 3 month.
You could get them in 1 and 3 months. And so that's how my parents kind of did it. And so that's how I would do it. But right in all of those downturns before World of Warcraft, I played all of the Aria games. And that's A-E-R-I-A. And it could be Aria. I say Aria because like Aria is like Area of Effect. So for the purposes of this, it's Aria games.
Yeah.
And those were a bunch of like free to play, free, maybe flash games that were not browser based, but you like downloaded them off of a website and they were free and then you just played them. And I also think that one of the games that I somehow got from this Aria games site was Shin Megami Tensei Online, which is also another MMO.
Yeah.
And it could not be that, to be completely honest with you. Because when you're a kid and you're just downloading all of these games for free, you're like, who cares about titles? I'm just playing 15 MMOs at once. Yeah, I'm cool. But you basically got a demon as a pet, and by capturing other demons, you could fuse the demons together to create something stronger, all within like a different world. And like the cities are all collapsing and you had to go and basically work with people or by yourself to level up your creature slash yourself and your skill level. And then through these combinations, keep going. And so that was the most, I bring that example up only because it was the most unique kind of area that wasn't like World of Warcraft. But then when you look at like Rift, and you look at, what's another, there was Rift, WoW, and there was like one more MMO that I can't think of. We'll also bring up Guild Wars 2. But you look at all of those, and I played all of those, and I'm like, I love all of them, but I always kept coming back to WoW. I would still come back to the 1 month or the 3 months, even though I could try to play these other MMO properties, because it was something that was unforgiving. It was like you had to work just a little too hard to play the game, versus with WoW, you could get in, there was a rhythm, you got your rhythm going, and then like you could play for days. And it's really interesting. It's really hard to capture, because even as a designer, I can make all the arguments for why WoW does it really well, but then I'll play something like Guild Wars 2. I'll just go back to Guild Wars and I'll go like, but this has it too. So like what makes one more accessible over the other?
So with WoW, the thing that you can never discount is the parasocial aspect. The fact that WoW is in many ways an engine for socialization. It kind of became that by accident, mostly because like it was a popular MMO, and then through being a popular MMO, it brought together a lot of people. And this was, you know, also around the same time when things like Vent and TeamSpeak were starting to become more commonly used. And so you weren't just like logging in and seeing a character's name and seeing them type stuff in chat like you would in, say, EverQuest or Dark Age of Camelot, or, you know, some of these older MMOs. you're actually like talking to people, and also sort of the since raiding was far more accessible, like in EverQuest, raiding guilds were basically people with no lives, because you couldn't do it otherwise. Whereas in WoW, raiding was far more accessible, especially as expansions went on, because they started like, you know, breaking down raiding into tiers. Initial like raid dungeons were usually much easier. So like in, you know, Wrath of the Lich King, they essentially like brought back Naxxramas. So most people already knew how to do it. It was just like tuned slightly differently. And so as a result, you have people, you know, getting in a rhythm of meeting regularly, because, you know, WoW raids have weekly resets. And so, you know, they're getting together at the same time and they have like scheduled social interactions. And so that parasocial aspect has a real pull on people, because when you come back and or like you see people from your guild, or you have that actual like meaningful human interaction when you hear someone's voice, or you have that sort of like regularly scheduled interaction, like that's a big part of it. Because I'm gonna bag WoW a little bit, even in its current iteration. I think it's not a great game, like as a game that you experience through its gameplay. Like if you separate out all those parasocial aspects, it's a middling game, I think, especially by comparison with modern MMOs, which have just far superior gameplay. I'm gonna say that right now. That's my lay opinion.
No, for sure.
Yeah. But the thing is also like WoW has been in constant decline. Like WoW sort of figures prominently in people's imaginations because, like, as you were saying earlier, like it gets, you know, Blizzard gets a lot of press. Blizzard is a very prestigious company, and WoW has sort of been around for a long time. Like, even lay people know what it is. People who've never played the game before have some vague sense of what it is, but it's not a very popular game anymore, especially when you compare it with other MMOs. Like, it's just not.
No, I think that actually brings up a really interesting point, because I've been out of, say, I'll call it the MMO playing market or something weird like that, because I used to play every MMO I could get my hands on. Like, speaking of MMOs, the reason why I got off of WoW was probably because I played Star Wars The Old Republic ever since it came out, like, in 2012. And then I lost my account. Thanks, guys. And I lost my Splatorski, so I can never get in. That being said, I've been off of the MMO playing field for so long that what came up in a dev circle the other day was that there's this MMO called Black Desert Online that passed the 1 billion sales mark, which just completely blew my mind, because I'd never heard of it until like, I guess, a month ago or something when we were talking about it. And so now I'm like, I have to play Black Desert Online. I have to play, which is not free, but I have to play Genshin Impact, which is free and has been described as Breath of the Waifus. So I'm very excited about Breath of the Waifus.
It basically is.
so good. I'm going to quote that and put it on a t-shirt. Breath of the Waifus. Genshin Impact. it's going to be great. And those two that I really need to play. And when you look at those types of game mechanics and what's really compelling about them, it is, I would say, as a single player, more compelling, right, than World of Warcraft. Yeah. Now, what's funny is that when I actually played WoW and Burning Crusade, I had a couple of friends that played it, but I got them into it. I actually played alone. I played World of Warcraft mainly and primarily alone for like years. I won't say how many years, but I'll just say years. Some amount of time. Then when I got back into WoW, while I have friends that work at Blizzard and I have friends that like had a WoW-themed wedding, like I didn't even tell them I was on retail yet. Because I was like, I really just want to play WoW by myself. And I get that we say WoW isn't, say, or, you know, you say, hey, WoW isn't a great game when you compare it to all these other factors. For me, I'm actually still trying to figure out, why do I like playing WoW alone when I could be playing another MMO that has less parasocial, right, interactions also alone? Yeah. Is it just because WoW is familiar? Because that's totally valid.
No, like, I don't.
WoW is familiar, and that's why I enjoy it. I don't think
it is that WoW was familiar. One, so the major improvement post Cataclysm is that they really improved how leveling works, like the leveling experience in WoW, and they started to do this in Wrath of the Lich King. They were sort of laying the foundations for it, but it was really Cataclysm that sort of made the whole leveling experience far more cohesive, and so you could have individual gameplay that was far less taxing, and you could break up into much more manageable chunks. There was a lot less grinding. You didn't just have to like constantly pull them up. It's not like you didn't have quests where like somebody was sending you out into the wilderness to collect, you know, 40 bear butts, but only like one in every 10 bears has a butt for some reason. And so you're killing like 400 of the same mob for this quest.
Actually, if you haven't picked up WoW actually recently, not only have they completely made leveling incredibly easy to manage, like leveling is almost just inherent now because there are so many levels in the experience that like every bear has a butt, and so you only need to get 10 bears because each bear has a butt. Have you played recently?
I played Legion, and when I played Legion, so I both had my what did I play in Legion? I played mostly my Paladin in Legion. But the other thing that I did, in fact, the reason why I stuck with it for a little while is because I leveled a Goblin Warrior. And I don't get it. Like people, especially in WoW, like WoW players crap on goblins and the whole like goblin thing. I thought the goblin leveling experience was delightful. I thought it was fantastic. I loved the fact that it leaned into sort of like the cartoonishness of the game, because in many ways, that's what I think the game does better. When the game is serious, I actually find it to be kind of corny and not really that interesting. But when the game is really sort of like tongue in cheek, and you know, it has all the like the weird, stupid puns and wordplay, or like there's, you know, clearly like oblique references to popular media, that's when I think it's at its best. And the goblin, especially like leveling up to, how far did I get? I think I got to 35 when I stopped playing. That whole experience was just delightful. I loved it. I thought it was great. I loved the goblin starting zones. And you're right, it was far more cohesive. Like you very clearly went from A to B to C. But the problem that I have with the leveling experience in WoW is that it doesn't teach you how to play the game. In other words, what I mean by that is that there is a way that you're like with each class and with each spec, there is a particular way you are almost certainly going to have to play it when you do reach max level, and the game doesn't really teach you how to do that.
Yeah, okay. So that actually goes into something that's like really interesting to me as a developer, is when you look at single player design and you look at teaching a person how to play their class, because it is not in an MP setting, you can easily and organically teach them as they're leveling, like these are the skills that you'll need to use, and here is how you will play, and here is how that this experience is going to work for you. But when you're in a multiplayer setting, suddenly like all the rules are off. And I think that's exactly what you're hitting on, is that now when you're playing an MMO, how you're going to need to play this class for like a group setting, depending on how you want to do it. Like it doesn't exist. And is it because it's a multiplayer experience? And so I would like to know, does Final Fantasy 14 like do this in a way that actually teaches you how you're going to play that class?
Yes.
And also, is it with the like presumption that you're going to be playing it within a party? Yep. And does that differ for then how they would tell you to play that solo?
So the answer is yes, yes, and mostly. So the first one, does Final Fantasy 14 teach you how to play your particular class? The answer is yes. And I think in particular, like, even though I have frustrations about how healing works in the game, healing is very it's not intuitive. And also it's not really something you can do as, like when you're playing a DPS spec, you know, doing damage to creatures is fundamentally the same when you're doing it just by yourself as when you're doing it in a dungeon. But the problem is there's not really an aspect of healing in the sort of like standard MMO, like doing quests grind thing that like you can really be taught through the gameplay mechanics. So this is where I think actually having the main storyline, so in many ways there are like two main storylines. There's the main storyline for the game, sort of like what is happening in the world and how you progress from a nobody into like the champion of everything. But then there is also a storyline for your class. So when you start out as a conjurer, and like, so every five levels there is like a major quest series that you have to do in order to gain abilities, like in order to gain your next, I don't really agree with this as a design decision, but I can understand why they do it. Because part of what is involved in each of those quests is essentially teaching you how to use those abilities. And I think the game could do more of this, but there are instances where the scenarios that are set up for you do actually require you to heal. They require you to heal NPCs that are tanking on your behalf or doing damage on your behalf. There's one where, like, you actually have to mix healing with doing damage, where there's a scenario where you're helping these two other white mages who are trying to, like, purge this evilness from a big tree. And so part of that is you have to help heal the tree to keep it alive, even as, like, other things in the forest are coming to attack it. So you have to kill the things that are attacking it and heal the tree and help out the other two who are trying to purge the tree so that they don't get killed. And so it teaches you a certain degree of situational awareness and what you have to do as a healer in order to be successful. I don't think it does enough of this. But the fact that it does it at all, I found to be kind of remarkable, because honestly, I've never played an MMO where it actually, like, puts you in a scenario where you have to figure out how to do something that is that fundamental to your class. I wish dungeons were more forgiving. I wish there was less of, like, essentially sticking, like, one new person with three people who are power leveling, because it's, like I said, especially with as unforgiving as healing is, to put somebody who is totally new into that situation with only sort of like the basic healing instruction that they've gotten through these quests, it's not enough. But like I said, the fact that it does it at all is nice. And also, because you have to do that for your character as well as for the main storyline, it gives you this sort of sense of character progression that is actually independent of the main storyline. So the main storyline quests, you know, they move you through all the cool stuff and you find out what the world is. But the character quests are generally give you much better gear. In fact, the gear that you get from the level 50 white mage quest, you keep for a very long time. It also looks really cool. It looks like the classic, like, Final Fantasy white mage outfit. It's kind of awesome. but in addition to that, it gives you a sense of, like, your character has many places in the world, and so it gives you the sense of, like, I actually find it kind of remarkable that an MMO can do this, or any game can do this, where it's sort of like, it shows you how open the world is, not just in terms of, like, its size and its environments, because that's usually what people mean when they say, like, an open world game.
Yep.
They're talking about, like, the freedom. They're talking essentially about, like, a sandbox situation of freedom of movement. But this actually shows you how the world is open in a social sense, because it shows you how your character actually has different ways to relate to the world around you, into the context in which you're playing.
I'm adding Final Fantasy 14 to my list. So something that, like, I'm really excited about when we talk about MMO and specifically, like, multiplayer open world design is what you're talking on, is that the relatability to the environment around you and your characterization, your, say, personification of the avatar, right, or the character that you're playing, is how much do you relate to them by how much can they relate to the world around them? How much of, say, the world do you have control over? Because usually, right, in MMOs, you don't really have over control of anything. You kind of accept quests, you can turn in quests, you can get gear, you can dismantle your gear or sell your gear, and you can kill things, right? Like, that's the extent of your interactions.
Usually, yeah.
And so to hear that, like, you have, but, right, you can accept quests. And so what Final Fantasy XIV sounds like it's doing is that at the very heart of the design, say, design floor table or design discussions, they were like, this is going to be an unforgiving, really hard experience where teamwork is going to be absolutely essential.
Yeah.
So in order to do that, they had to create, right? There's going to be the main storyline quest. It's almost like they fiated it. They kind of had to create a way for you to understand how to use those mechanics within this, right? Teamwork is going to be absolutely essential kind of methodology, right? Yep. It's not a celebration of power or a celebration of how cool you are. It is, no, you are struggling and fighting for your life. It's that struggle,
yeah,
right? And so with that theme of struggle, they're like, well, now you have to do the character quests. No, I guess have to, right?
But
you pretty much have to.
Yeah. There are certain abilities that are locked under class quests.
Yeah.
And you
and
have
so that to, even Rin, sorry.
And you have to do them in order. Like, so it's not like, so like if there is an ability that's locked behind, say like the level 45 class quest, you have to do all the ones previous to it. You can't do it independently.
Yeah, like because when I look at Final Fantasy 14, a reason why I haven't played it is because it's a struggle. And I don't like playing games that require me to struggle. Like I struggle every day in my life.
Yeah.
So maybe when I in a more secure like place, I'm not just moving every like 9 months and I'm like maybe settle down a little bit, I'll struggle in my Final Fantasy 14, right?
Yeah.
But like when I look at this game and I like understand your experience about it, there's something that's really fascinating about it because it reminds me of World of Warcraft Classic, because it's that struggle, right? Where teamwork is absolutely essential. It's that struggle where you have to find your role. And what WoW's design did was said, we have the internet and we're just going to use it to our advantage. We're not going to tell people what the game is about because the people, right, are going to figure it out just like they did in EverQuest and just like they did in Ultima. Like they're going to figure it out because they have the internet. They'll go to forums and they talk, right? And so Blizzard just had amazing community support. They're like, we'll just create this community around it. Yeah. And then it kind of created this like knowledge bank, right?
Yes.
Versus now Final Fantasy 14 coming a lot later was like, look, the internet is great and all, but the internet's huge. There's just way too much information on the internet.
Yeah.
Right. And not necessarily that, but also like we need a way to show in the game that struggle and like teamwork, because I don't think struggle is the say methodology of World of Warcraft. I don't think like if anything, it wasn't that it was please come and play with your friends and have fun.
Yeah. I don't think there was an ideology underlying it initially,
yeah.
At least.
Especially yeah, since, I don't think there was, there probably was, but I mean, come play with your friends, have fun is an ideology, right?
Because I think if they had like some like clear like parasocial design goals in mind, they wouldn't have allowed the like rampant toxicity that existed in like early WoW and its various expansions. Mm-hmm. Because
right?
Because the thing is, at the same time as it's great to say like, okay, the information's out there, we expect you to sort of go and figure it out, and that's part of the beauty of playing the game. And it is like learning about sort of like how to optimize your character in ways outside of the game. You're right, actually, I did like it. The problem with that is that because all of that got put onto sort of the parasocial realm, it meant that very quickly it evolved into like power gaming and various like enforced metagaming rules.
Yeah,
where
absolutely.
Like if you wanted to participate in particular forms of content and you played a particular class, you were essentially compelled by the people you played with to play that class in a particular way. And this
no,
was,
absolutely.
And this was definitely,
no, I just want to say, like, I was in a raid once. I played Molten Core once in my whole life, and it was this year, February 2020, before the COVID apocalypse. And I hated every minute of it. Like, I was thrust into a Discord server with, like, 40 other people, but there was only, like, maybe 25 or 30 or something. Did not realize that like there was etiquette to when you were supposed to log on and when you were supposed to be in the raid. Like I didn't know anything about global buffs or potions or whatever I needed to get.
Yep.
Like people just assumed a lot, especially for like a priest. And then when I didn't do stuff, people were like trying to find metrics on like how often was I dispelling or like how well were my heals and shit. And then to top it all off, I actually got 2 pieces of gear from the raid and then just like left that Discord server and never looked back. So no regrets. But that, like all of that being said, like it was just really like hard for me because it was all of those parasocial mechanics.
Yeah.
And when you look at like Blizzard's like early inception and they didn't really have that kind of culture, and you could contrast it to Final Fantasy 14, which did have a really clear vision, right? This actually goes all the way back into what we were talking about with company culture, because games at first of their inceptions or come like play this game, come have fun with your friends, or please play our game. It's a game. Games are fun. We promise it's fun. dear Lord, please be fun. We had to hand print 100 copies of these in our local like retailer by ourselves because we don't know how to outsource publishing, right? Like that's what it was. But now games, especially at this large scale, have to have a clear, solid vision. And people have to believe in this vision. They have to buy the vision that shared struggle is a really important concept for your game to be about, which means that all of the fun and mechanics have to talk about how we become better people because we have a shared struggle. And we can overcome things together. But if your company and the people working on something that has a vision of we with a shared struggle are better for overcoming things together, if the people don't believe that, then suddenly there's this disconnect and that instant creative friction with I'm creating something I don't believe in. And so now we look at, say, Blizzard's like future games, or we could look at any other company's future games and say, what are those games about? You can actually kind of see the schism in why that company there has to do like layoffs, or why the game doesn't perform to, say, the expectations of the consumer, or maybe where the marketing falls short of that game, where you're like, wow, that's not the game that I expected. It's because the culture and of the people making the game are going to influence the game more than the culture of the company. But a company is a body of people. And when people leave the company, they take that culture with them, whether it's good or bad, right? Yeah. And so now in our like modern era of gaming, I really see this trend, not just towards making games that are fun and exciting to play, though I do think that will still exist, but you're gonna see a lot of more developers and a lot of more of these big names create games and game companies surrounding those types of values that are going to bring people together that are about those types of creative vision, because that's what's really important in these games.
Yeah, I should note that what I was describing as parasocial, I should probably just describe as social. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, well, because it's kind of complicated.
I liked your word parasocial. I mean, well, because, it made it sound really cool.
Well, because parasocial,
like metaphysics.
Parasocial usually refers to sort of like an imagined relationship between somebody who's like in an audience and like something that is like they're connected to. It's essentially like a one-way thing where you have like a media figure or like a media environment, or like, you know, you imagine your relationship to, say, a character in a video game or to like a pop star or something like that, but there's no actual relationship there. And so there are parasocial aspects of like how this works in video games, especially since like, you know, certain people have, particularly in MMOs, there are certain like guilds that are prominent, or like there are particular like streamers who are really prominent, and you can have like a parasocial relationship with them. But there's also just an ordinary social relationship. But the problem is like the social relationship that you have with, say, like your guild mates or just like randos you meet in like through the dungeon finder oftentimes reflects the way you and other people have those other parasocial relationships. So I
that's exactly why I thought your term was actually fine. So for me, as someone who this actually also came up in a discussion last week, this is really interesting how this just happens to be flowing. But this also came up in discussion last week, which was how people on Zoom sometimes feel like they haven't met any of their coworkers for people that are being hired during this process because they've only been on Zoom. For me, I was on the internet actually over half my life now, which is exciting to say. But for over half my life, I spent on the internet meeting people. And for me, some of my best friends that I met online before I actually ever met in person.
Yeah.
To me, digitally meeting something or having a digital social relationship is just as valid, if not in some cases more valid than having ever met that person in reality. And what's interesting to me is that it is and does start as, I think, a parasocial relationship, especially when you look at, say, Twitter. Like you meet someone on Twitter,
okay,
whether or not they have a check mark, right? Like you meet someone on Twitter and you're like, wow, I love what you say, et cetera. And then you slowly begin to like cultivate what could or could not be a relationship, right? Like there's this person out there that they don't know who you are, but then something, maybe they see you and also now are parasocially interacting with you as someone. They're like, oh, you're really cool. Suddenly you have these two media figures talking until eventually like there's a line. I don't even want to call it a line. It's really more of a spectrum where something, it just blends. And now it's a social relationship where you and this other person who have only ever communicated, say, via tweets or Twitter, are now actually in a like committed, right, social friendship, right? Or even acquaintanceship. Right.
Yeah, parasocial almost doesn't make sense in those. It's one of the reasons why I sort of, after the fact, I was like, is this really describing what I think it's describing? Is because, yeah, there isn't a line anymore. Because, you know, especially when you're talking about like popular media figures, there used to be a fairly hard distance, like a social distance between, you know, the audience or fans or like fan culture and the people themselves. Now, especially when you're talking about like people who have become famous in, say, like Twitch streamers is a really good example of this, where like you actually, like there is no clear dividing line. You can start as a rando who admires someone and you can actually develop either, you know, a decent or a weird or a good or a toxic or any kind of relationship with that individual because the communication barrier isn't there as much.
Yep, I think absolutely. And so like hell, I'll even use myself as an example, is that because of my work on my current right project, I got a lot of new followers on Twitter and I also got followers on Instagram. For me, I treat everybody as a human, and I'm pretty good about seeing like, is this person private messaging me like something that looks very suspicious? I'm gonna block them. Or is this person just going like, hey, I saw your story and I really love the fact that you worked on this game that I enjoy. So for me, when I get a message like that, I'm like, thank you. That's just all I say, right? And yeah. Some of these people are like, that's it. Like, they're like, oh man, like, thank you. But some of them are like, thank you so much for responding, right? Like, you can tell that they're like, wow, like you, they want to enter that. They have looked at me as a parasocial relationship. Like, they've looked at me as some high figure. I only have like 600 followers on Instagram, guys. Like, I'm not big.
Yeah.
Right. It's not like I'm secretly like in the 24Ks or whatever, right? I've only got like 600 people. And this is one of those people that's just like, thank you so much for responding. I can't believe it. Like, and then they just gush more about it, right? Like, they're getting these little fan DMs. And like, yeah. A lot of them are really nice. And so I like screenshot them and I share them to my coworkers to be like, hey guys, like, you're doing a good job. This is great. Keep it up. Cause it's not just all me, right?
Yeah.
But even me, right, in that parasocial relationship, like you could say, looking across the way to someone that's just like, I love this. In another phrase, someone like really liked one of my coffee posts and then suddenly is located in the Bay Area and was like, hey, here's actually where you need to go here. Oh, by the way, this is where you should get your groceries because of COVID. Like, this is where like there won't be any lines.
Yeah.
And now it's become some, I wouldn't say, it's definitely not parasocial anymore, right? It's not just someone like, oh, this person is admiring my work. It's now like, hey, I need to help this person out because we have a shared experience of our location.
Well, it's weird because it's sort of, it almost is the case that proves the non-distinction because so when people describe something as parasocial, oftentimes they're trying to enforce a distinction, and that distinction may be real. There may be real like communicative and social distance between people. And when I say social distance, I'm not talking about the, you have to stand 6 feet apart from somebody. I mean, there's actually like in terms
of the digital
of,
distance.
Yeah. Your social circles don't really overlap. That's what I mean. But that there's a huge swath of interactions, particularly online, that where that terminology just doesn't make sense. And I think that's where, I think that's what we're trying to get at, is this idea that like, in many ways, the sort of the world in which, and a lot of people enter into that sort of quasi, I guess maybe it's better to say quasi-social. Well, no,
because I like that term a lot, but it's weird. But
the thing is, it is just social. Like, because the thing is,
it's just social. At the end of the day, like when you look at these things called social media,
yeah,
like it's called social media because it is social media. Like, you cannot have let me rephrase this. You can have an Instagram profile that is just parasocial, right? You're a really well-known celebrity or you're a really well-known business, a brand, a corporate entity.
Yeah.
And you're parasocial.
Yeah.
Right. Old Navy has 1.6 million followers on Instagram. And I don't know who needs to be marketed to where they feel like they need to follow Old Navy, but they do. Right. And that is a parasocial relationship. Old Navy is not going to strike up a really cute conversation.
Yeah.
But I will actually then contrast this to a lot of the Starbucks Instagram accounts, because I do follow the Starbucks Instagram accounts because I'm someone that needs to be marketed to more by Starbucks.
Because you are an addict, because you are a genuine addict.
I am an addict. Yes, I am an addict. And but they also post really nice photos and I wanted like, it's my inspiration. And one of them on there, they are run by humans, right? They're run by social media managers, right? And so I posted or reposted something that one of them did, and they were like, hey, we'd love for you to come visit the store. Wow, that is an instant, right, social kind of validation of my existence as a human being on this note. right, but someone could see it like that.
Yeah.
And that's where I think this parasocial, social kind of divide is super, super breaking down as we get into more of the online presence of these like shared world experiences, because we have that shared world experience on the internet. So like, I guess in a way, like you saying parasocial was accurate for like, say the old beginning of the podcast where we were looking at it, like in the old methodology of online interactions.
What I was trying to think about now is social. Yeah. What I was trying to think about was this type of sociality that video games facilitate. And it involves, I mean, it's similar to what you see in other forms of media, but also like social media is weird, especially when you're talking about Twitter, because Twitter, you're essentially broadcasting. Like you can like have interactions that feel much more like a kind of like intimate, like group relationship, or sorry, a larger group relationship. Sorry, I'm trying not to pick at my various rashes and lesions, which is not fun. Sorry, what was I saying? But for like one of the things that I think a game like WoW did in a way that other MMOs did not, and so this is what it, this is one of its like sort of its accidental genius, is that it facilitated a kind of sociality that actively breaks down that sort of para quasi social, like all of those ways in which we try to make distinctions between social relationships, like it actively just sort of made cause that to deteriorate.
I definitely agree with that. Yeah. Because when you look at retail WoW and you look at say WoW Now and you want to like level up your tank female Pandaren drunken master, you don't have to play with anybody, and the social relationship between you and anybody else on that server, like you're basically all power leveling at that point. You don't need to talk to anybody. You don't need to wait around for kills to respawn and have that kind of unspoken of like, hey, I know you just killed that guy. Can I kill the next one? Cause like these werewolves are not going to respawn in time for me to kill them. And I think that there's this unspoken, it becomes this unspoken societal norm of the environment that creates that sort of social, right? Necessitation for social activity. Versus like now in retail, you don't actually have that, you don't need it, but it's made the game a lot more successful, like, and or not successful, but accessible.
Accessible, yeah.
Accessible. Yeah. It's made it a lot faster. You can like get to the end game, which then requires you, but conversely, you aren't ever needed to learn how to create like those end game right roles for yourself. You never need to do it. Versus in classic, if you take the 8 days and you run every single dungeon kind of en route, you start to learn what you need to do in the dungeon mentality.
Yeah. And also in a more forgiving environment. Like there.
Yeah.
So what I was talking about earlier with like the way I feel Final Fantasy 14 kind of teaches you how to play your role. There is, I think, one exception to WoW's general tendency not to do this, and that's in Westfall, and Westfall is a really, really brilliantly designed zone. It's probably one of only a handful of brilliantly designed zones in the game.
I hate Westfall, but
I'm gonna make the argument. So the reason why it's brilliantly designed is because like there's a lot of stuff going on there. It has a good density of quests. It's not friggin' huge like many WoW zones are.
That's very true. It's not the Barrens.
Barrens or like Teneris or Silithus, like where you feel like you're just
all I'm running. Hearing are all of the horde areas are so flat and barren.
They really are. Well, no, but the thing is like, but take a zone like it's not even a zone, but like Shimmering Flats, which is part of
all of the horde areas are flat and barren.
No, but Shimmering Flats is a really well designed zone because it has a theme. It has the whole like race
course.
The whole race course, and it has a fairly high density of quests.
I actually agree with the whole Westfall argument that I think you might be making, because I remember playing Westfall. I remember enjoying Westfall, but I remember I was there too long, and that is why.
But the thing is, what you do, but the quests that you do in Westfall, they guide you towards the major dungeon in that zone. And it's not just like the Defias quest line. There's also like Defias related stuff that you do as like side quests. And so to like the game is telling you the story of what's going on in that zone. And then in the process of telling you that story, and also it has quests that are unlike a lot of early other starter quests in other zones, where like you have to do escort missions, you have to like find couriers. There's like more interesting types of things that you have to do, and those all contribute to going into this dungeon, the Dead Mines, and like and it's not a particularly hard dungeon,
Actually a
really.
hard dungeon either, but they did completely like redo it in retail
That's true,
now
yeah.
from Classic
It's
Quest
different
Burning,
now.
because I played it in Burning Crusade, or I played it back in the day when I was Alliance in World of Warcraft, and I remember really enjoying Dead Mines, and then I got onto retail to show it to somebody that was just getting into retail with me, and it was so different that like I completely bombed the whole thing. I was just like, I don't know where I'm going, I don't know what I'm doing anymore,
It is
just because it
confusing.
looked
It's
so as like
confusing.
aesthetically different.
Yeah.
But that being said, yeah, like Westfall also ended up having that one quest with what was it? It had the quest where like you had to, it was like a mystery. You had to figure out who murdered someone, and it was by going into the cornfield and discussing with like ghost children or something.
And then like what immediately follows Westfall is Duskwood, which is also a really, it's not
Oh,
as,
Duskwood is
I don't think
amazing.
it's as well designed because it does have a lot of the runniness that I don't particularly enjoy. Like one of the things that really is annoying about WoW is how like all quest givers tend, not universally, but they tend to be located in exactly one spot. And then, but then they have quests for literally the entire zone. And so like some of your quests are literally going to be on the other side of the zone. You run back, get the next in the sequence, and then there's this sort of
Yeah,
like,
so there's like that's why like the guides were really helpful. But so the reason why I think Duskwell, so our Duskwood suffers where Westfall is exciting, is that Westfall was allowed to do a correct hub level design that then facilitated you to kind of bottleneck into the Dead Mines.
yeah.
Because you can see the Dead Mines is actually at the bottom of the map, versus when you look at Westfall, it actually has like a hub and spokes where you actually can go all around and most of your quest givers are in the center.
Exactly.
And that was a it was allowed to do that. Allowed, I'm going to say in production terms, because it's kind of off to the side. There's nothing really there. And like there's just coast, and then it has these two other areas in the river. So it truly is an island of beauty, right? But then when you come to Duskwood, you actually have to run through Duskwood to get from like what the like Burning Steps, but also Stranglethorn Vale. You have to run through Duskwood to get like Horde territories, right? So it's not actually, even though when you look at the map, you can see where potentially they wanted to do that hubs design where they've placed the center, like center town. Actually, you have, you see that they had to kind of push it up, right? In
Well,
level
that
design terms, you can see they had to shove it because they have like the two villages. Yeah, whereas we do our little things. So they have two villages, but you can see they kind of had to shove things around a bit. At least
So
I feel like I see it because they had to create that through line, not for the Alliance players, but
Oh,
for
okay,
the
I see what
Horde
you're saying.
players.
So because so I'll just, for those of you who haven't played WoW, I'll sort of describe how Duskwood is laid out. Duskwood essentially has four, I would say like five parts. So that so you
Yep,
have you have
five.
a you have a road that runs east-west through like the like two-thirds. So if you think of like sort of an oval on its side and sort of a rectangular oval, like in the dead center of that oval is this huge unused part for most of the early part of the game, because it's essentially like a giant portal for like a raid with green dragons, and it was patched in later in the game. So then on the right hand, like upper third, you have the town, the actual town that where all your quest givers are, and where the human people are, et cetera, et cetera. And then on the left-hand side, you have where most of the actual mobs that you're going to have to fight are. And then, so then below that left-hand third, there are areas with worgen and spiders and various other creepy people. And then on the bottom right-hand side, there are like skeletons and so forth. And so the thing is, because you have this giant unused area in the dead center, it means that you're constantly ping-ponging back and forth from one side to the other. Whereas what Lauren is saying is that if like that zone had been designed well for questing, you would have put the town where that is, so that way you can sort of radiate out into other directions and it's more centrally located. However, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, they couldn't do that precisely because of the way the zones connect to each other. And since you like going through Duskwood is a primary like horde path to get from Stranglethorn Vale into Alliance territory, like they needed to shunt that off. They needed to shunt the town off to one side because you didn't want to literally have like horde constantly ruining the Alliance leveling experience, which they which they did anyway. So
no, absolutely. But what actually you actually can look at is that I would like to argue that the portal was actually closer to that higher level area, Deadwind Pass, over on the left, because it is surrounded by all of those mountains. And I would like to say that the town was in the center, but precisely because they had Horde players running through that area, the village was not protected because of the Horde. And also, right, because the Horde players themselves conversely didn't like being camped by Alliance, they ended up having to change that level entirely. So while it was actually set up quite like Elwynn and Westfall, and Duskwood was actually set up with that more of a hub radiating design out into the questing zone areas, that they had to actually make that swap, which is why Duskwood, while it has an incredible story, actually feels really weird, right? And it doesn't actually feel correct, because doesn't it look, if you look at Twilight Grove on the map, which is in the center, doesn't it look like it would just fit perfectly in with those mountains? Like, why would they put mountains in the middle of the map there?
Well, they put it there because they have to block it off.
They have to block it off. Yeah. But like, you already have mountain range in your environment over here. Yeah. There is no need for you to change the environment of this area. Anyway, so yeah, that's the argument that I would like to make.
You're right. It very easily could have been in the sort of the upper right-hand side of the area. It could have been further south. It could have been like in the bottom right-hand side where Tranquil Garden Cemetery is. Like, that's a more logical location for a mountainous thing to be.
Yep. And I absolutely 100% think that it was because of playtests, and or you could even say paper playtests, where they just had people mimic running around the world, where they ended up having to move. The town is now called Darkshire. That's on the right side.
Yeah.
Or the east side of the map.
Yeah.
And then Twilight Grove is that raid area we were talking about. I 100%. 99%, because I mean, you can never be 100% sure in games, but I definitely think that one of the reasons why this map design ended up the way it did was because it wasn't this way to begin with.
Okay.
And then they moved it because of, right, wanting to protect the village and stuff.
Yeah, because I'm thinking back. So a lot of the zones, especially in the human side of the equation, like a lot of zones that are in World of Warcraft, like are taken from Warcraft 3.
Yes.
And I don't think there actually is a Warcraft 3 like correspondent to Duskwood. Maybe there was, I just don't remember.
Honestly, your guess is as good as mine. I don't quite remember. I love Duskwood despite all of the ping-ponging, because it really was, for me, coming out of Westfall and Elwynn, where I was like, okay, Westfall's cool and all, but Duskwood's like kind of gothic, like mystery and also like horror kind of aspect to it. I just really liked the super stark contrast from the other areas.
Well, I mean, it's the other major advantage. I mean, the one of the primary advantages that Duskwood had is, well, one, there's a fairly natural progression, like from Elwynn Forest to Westfall, but then also like Red Ridge is on the other side of Elwynn, so you can sort of go there first if you want. But also, like, just there are a lot of quests in Duskwood. Like, there are a lot of things to do. And what sort of causes WoW to drag, what caused vanilla WoW to drag, particularly like post 40, was that you had zones that were like twice the size of the starting zones and had fewer quests.
Mm-hmm. And it was also because, though, they actually had elite quests, which gave you double the bonus.
Yeah.
So you were supposed to be able to party up with, like, say, random people and create this pickup group and then go into an elite area and then get, say, double the amount, right, for, say, fewer the quest givers. And so while it looks, say, good on paper, like, that paper balancing didn't really work out in play, especially because since the areas were bigger, there was a less likelihood of you actually meeting someone to even pick up. And by the time that you had people flying from a city in, if you were there already, like, they already had their group together.
And that right there, and that what you just said about the fact that, like, in these upper levels, you were far less likely to, like, run into people who could help you. Like, that's why I think, okay, I'm gonna stop the screen share for a second. That's why I think that
Blizzard didn't actually have the social aspects of the game really in mind at the in the design stages, because if they had had that in mind, they would have thought about things, you know, basically unpopulated zones or giant zones. Or, I mean, it's also entirely possible that a lot of the later zones aren't as complete simply because they're just unfinished. Like, they're as complete as they needed to be to ship.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. But what's also interesting is that when you look at a thing like Legion is the ultimate, right, hub and spokes kind of area, where it is just an end game. I'll put end game in scare quotes because it's no longer end game.
Yeah.
It's just a nice scare quotes end game area where you have like this major city in the center, little center-ish enough, and then you're able to kind of go off into these other regions. But you can also look at how they didn't have the social aspect in, say, the world or the environment or level design, because the feature that actually allowed you to meet people faster was a systemic feature. It was a button, dungeon finder, find a dungeon, find a people, solved problem. Like, yeah. It was a very systemic and I'll call it rational design sort of like philosophy. Now, it's not to nix the dungeon finder, because I actually quite like dungeon finding as a feature, but like if they had had encountering social like relationships and social people through the world,
yeah,
then they would have solved the problem through the world design. But because they didn't have that at the onset, like you said, they ended up implementing Dungeon Finder because they're like, the problem is people can't find people to dungeon with. Not the fact that the space was too large. It's they just read the problem like on paper. So they solved it on paper.
Yeah, well, the problem is like, so it's almost like they were constantly trying to hotfix social problems in the game. I still think to this day, Blizzard just does not have, I mean, maybe I'm going on a limb here. Maybe they actually do understand this and just don't know how to, or like haven't implemented it well, but they've never, to my mind, they've never really had a good understanding of how the social aspects of the games can be engineered. Like, they're really glad that it happens and they're willing to sort of create systems after the fact that like help people along, like, you know, Dungeon Finder. But the thing is also Dungeon Finder was itself kind of a quick fix to a problem, because it doesn't actually encourage all that much social interaction.
It completely actually nixes the social interaction, right? Just like in retail WoW, where you don't need to have social interaction anymore. If you go into a dungeon and you're a solo player, I think you automatically enter the Dungeon Finder system. At least I think that's how it happened for me. And then they just meet you with a party automatically. And then you never even have to engage with any sort of social, say, norms that were in the original WoW. Yeah. Now, I don't want to speak to anything that modern Blizzard is doing, one, because I do have friends that work there and I would never want to say anything that they may or like they could be potentially working on, just in supposition.
100%
even though I haven't like
opinion.
Talked to them.
100% my opinion.
No, this absolutely. Is not the, so yeah. one, yeah, 100, like eh, not 100% my opinion, because like I kind of believe this, but I also am a realist. But I do think that Blizzard is taking approaches into figuring out how to engineer better social behavior, and I say this because of the program of Overwatch. And Overwatch instituted game mechanics specifically to award basically team leaders, team players, and most valuable play, and celebrating teamwork and positive behavior, right? Yeah. And so while I do think that World of Warcraft and, you know, even StarCraft don't necessarily have those mechanics, Overwatch, one of their newer titles, does have game mechanics that are about influencing and promoting positive social behavior. So I do think that future things, maybe like Shadowlands, will have it. But I'm not, I mean, I can't actually speak to whether it will or it won't. But I do think that they're trying to figure out what engineers it. But as a game developer, I would like to say, wow, like engineering social behavior, like what is that even? Like that is a whole other topic. That's like a Zuckerberg topic.
Yeah, it also sort of
like
that's
not really a game designy.
as a Marxist, that also takes me into very queasy territory the history of social engineering in communist countries is
not a good one. it's kind of
yeah,
a bad
I
one.
Am. Yeah, I don't want us to get into a discussion about that. And I don't think we were trying to either. I just wanted to completely state it out there on the podcast for all the listeners out there is that we were not trying to get into a discussion about that. No. But many of you may have picked up on the certain cues of things that we could have said that. But that is not what we were trying to do. It was just looking at how social mechanics interact within the game space in a completely virtual, non-real world.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's episode. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are sold. You can rate and review us on iTunes, since it really helps with getting the pod out to more people. Or just spread the word the old-fashioned way, by carrier pigeon or on the lecture circuit, I guess. You can follow Lauren on Twitter at TheLaurenAsh. That's TheLaurenAsh. Or you can follow me at UAHSENAA. And you can follow the podcast at Furidashi Pod. So that's FURIDASHIPOD. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Until then, try not to let the apocalypse get you down. Bye.